ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Shift Extension Podcast. I'm your host, Nick, and co-host, Sonny Whitfield. How are you, Sonny?
Yeah, good, mate. I just sort of let you know I've got a really, really shonky internet connection today, and I've also got a shonky battery. So if I vanish from this podcast, I do apologise, but you got Andy to fill my shoes, which he may or may not do.
Gentlemen, always a pleasure, and looking forward to today. I have had the opportunity to work actually side by side with Kat in some of the environments in which we're going to be talking about today. So I'm looking forward to her perspective and take on things.
I'd like to introduce our very special guest on today's podcast. Kat wrote an article for the Shift Extension. It was entitled Underestimated and Underutilized, the Private Paramedicine Sector. Welcome, Kat. Thank you so much for coming on.
I'm excited to be here.
So, Kat, you are a paramedic. You just finished your studies last year. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences since finishing university, where you've worked and where you are now?
So I had the privilege of, I already worked in the private sector since about my first year into my degree. I worked as a medic. So I just skilled up, set qualifications and became a graduate paramedic in the private sector. Mm-hmm. And I did that up until I got the call from QAS inviting me to work for them in May. So January to May, I worked in the private sector, and now I'm up in Bundy working for the QAS.
Fantastic. Congratulations on your new role. What prompted you or what motivated you to write this article about the private paramedic sector?
Not necessarily sure what prompted me, other than I thought that the Shift Extension was a fantastic publication, and I really wanted to write something. And I felt like working in the private sector, I am offering a bit of a different perspective. And having done the private sector work for about 3 years as a medic and a paramedic, I could offer some good insights and hopefully encourage more qualified paramedics to consider working in the private sector as well.
There was some great insight for me, literally from the first three words of the article. There's a hidden message in that title. You're not alluding to this. What was the reason behind the title of the article?
Well, for anyone who wants to read the article, I feel like it explains it quite well, but definitely underutilized and underestimated. I think that people get surprised by what kind of work paramedics, private paramedics can do, myself included. When I first started, I thought, isn't it just, you know, Saturday private school sport, just get some ice, do some bandaging? But it's so much more than that. You can do so much work in the private sector, from mining to where I work in the events, to even in some countries you can go to Antarctica and be a paramedic out in the ice. There's so much you can do, and I think it's often just swept aside, so to speak, because it's not, you know, it's not jurisdictional service, it's not the state service. So it's not the same, but you just a different kind of exposure you get. It's a different kind of work you do as a paramedic.
This would certainly, it might confuse some of the international listeners, because, you know, there are vastly different paramedic and ambulance systems in the world. Now, in Australia, we've got a heavily state-run or jurisdictionally run ambulance service networks. Every state has been controlling what paramedics can and can't do right up until about 2018 when we registered as a health professional. And since then, the private sector has been growing. So it might seem a little bit strange, certainly to some of the US listeners and things like that, where the private sector is actually the larger part of what they do. But just for those listeners, you know, it's a state-run ambulance service, but paramedics are certainly starting to grow these private sector experiences. Now, you mentioned, apart from mining and the resource sector, you also mentioned events. What are some of the examples of events that that private paramedics have been influencing or starting to move into?
Well, some of the big ones that the company I work for, they cover a lot of stadiums, and that doesn't just include necessarily the people that come and watch the games, but it also includes being out in the field, being field side. So you're the paramedic. As a private paramedic, you're there that if a player goes down, it's your job to go and get the player and quickly assess the player, bring them to the doctors, which back in the day was really state paramedics, that's what they did. And for example, I think because of a lot of insurances now, for example, the Brisbane race courses, they need to have paramedics, certain amount of paramedics on staff, drag racing, motocross, BMX, they require to have paramedics and or nurses on staff. And the private sector really is picking up that workload, because I don't think necessarily where I work can provide the paramedics, because they're already so short-staffed themselves, they can't provide the paramedics to cover these events. So these events are coming to the private sector, and the private sector is doing just as good a job providing care for the players and the participants.
I'm gonna actually take that even further, Kat, and I'm going to say that the private sector providers in those particular types of environments are probably doing a better job than the state-based services, and that's because they are able to tailor their services to those actual types of events.
And that's just classic Andy Bell being controversial. He's trying to get some people on the, you know, hate train at the moment. But
it's
a relevant point.
He makes a good point.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're not wrong, Andrew.
No, and look,
I believe he's called a constructive disruptor. We're going to emphasise the disruptor part.
But ambulance services, like traditionally, their environment was looking after the general public out and about, usually in their homes, but also in other places. There's a high demand for that service, and there's only so much resources you can put at something when the demand increases. So the idea that an ambulance service can continue to look after all aspects of out-of-hospital care, well, it's just not feasible from a logistics perspective and a financial perspective. And there's absolutely no problem with companies, like private companies, coming out and being able to find their little niche in the out-of-hospital arena and do it really well. And that's what's happening. We're seeing more and more of it in Australia.
Paramedics are even going one step further, Nick, because, historically it's been ambulance services. Now there's private companies who are employing paramedics in things like what Kat's been describing. But there's also paramedics who are now operating as sole traders and solo responders. They're not even part of companies. And it's a very grey area for paramedicine in Australia, because you start delving into things like scopes of practice and you know, clinical governance. That's a whole nother can of worms. Hey, Kat, Andy mentioned that you had the pleasure, displeasure, not sure which one, of working with him in the private sector. Where was that?
We actually worked at the New Year's Day Music Festival up in Sydney together.
And how can you describe his ability, his just
quite
knackered.
Good, really switched on.
he spent more time in the mosh pit than he did actually doing any work.
The checks in the mail,
that's
obviously.
That's where our work was. That's we actually picked up a couple of patients from the mosh pit, which is
exactly. So you know,
literally picked up patients over our shoulders and carried them out of the mosh pit. I believe was a couple of the options. My comment before about private providers doing a better job is actually based in an experience. You know, I've sat on both sides of the fence here, and one of the things that I've experienced is that the private providers, particularly those who are now doing this, you know, on the regular, it's extremely frequent, they have a huge amount of experience in these types of events, have the ability to be able to tailor their staff, their scope of practice, their equipment, their setups, their systems to the events. And things like jurisdictional ambulance services just cannot do that, because it's not the daily, it's not the bread and butter of those services. And so I actually genuinely believe that that is the future for these types of events. They aren't going to utilise jurisdictional ambulance services because they aren't the specialists in those areas. And we're going to start to see more and more specialisation within paramedicine. We already see it in nursing. You know, you can do your nursing degree and then you can become a cardiac nurse, or you can do pediatrics, or you can do obstetrics, and you can do
mental health.
Yeah, exactly. We will start to see more and more of that starting to occur across the broad range of paramedicine. And there will be a specialisation within paramedicine in this event space over time.
Do you think, Andrew, that – oh, Andy, I keep calling you Andrew. Do you think,
I know,
Andy, that –
very formal, Nicholas. I don't understand why.
Yes, Mr. At Bell.
Least,
only his
have
mother
Stephen
calls him
here
Andrew.
To keep us in check. Yeah.
Do you think, Andy, because paramedics, you know, part of our definition is about the different environments that we work in, do you think our specialization will be less around the type of medicine that we're doing and more around the environment for which we're working in?
Yeah, look, that's a really good point, Nick, and I think that it's probably going to have to be something like that. I don't think we can continue to be this Jack and Jill of all trades and a master of none when we are operating in these different types of environments all the time, particularly if we want to do a really good job. So someone like Kat, who's gone and done work in this area, is going to have a skill set which differs from someone who, for example, has worked in another area of specialization, let's say pediatrics or something. So it just makes sense that we have a broad sort of overriding skill set that gives us our fundamental skills. And then outside of that, we generate these specialities that we're able to then really drill into the nuances of that particular environment.
Why underutilized then, Kat? I mean, obviously there's a gap in what paramedics have been providing, and it needs to be filled, and it needs to be filled by the private sector growing and evolving. Why underutilized, do you think? You're the one who's got the perspective at the moment, and I'm really interested in this.
Well, underutilized because we could be used as private paramedics in the private sector. We could be used so much more. I come from Russia, for example, and in Russia, the private sector is, you know, often the people you, when you have any kind of medical emergency, you can call the private sector or the public sector. So to me, to come into Australia where it's just public sector, and if I've fallen on the floor, for example, I get categorized as, you know, a low on the scale because I'm not emergent, but then I'm waiting for hours. And I think it's the kind of work that the private sector can pick up. And why wouldn't they be able to? Like, you're qualified paramedic. You're qualified much like everyone else. You work under APRA. You work under the same capabilities. And I mean, you can have different CPMs and DTPs, your guidelines, sure. But I don't see necessarily why we're not utilizing private paramedics for some jobs that, you know.
This is the underutilization now that you also talked about. And I mean, look, all three of us that are here talking today, all three of us have both worked in jurisdictional ambulances and in the private sector. We're doing the opposite to you. We started in jurisdictional ambulance services, and now we're moving into the private sector. You've come the other way. There's certainly been an ingrained culture for the last decade that I've been serving, that certainly underestimates to the point of disrespecting the private sector from the paramedicine profession, because it has been heavily influenced by, jurisdictional culture. The underestimation is that coming from your own colleagues, or is that coming from the public? I'm curious.
I personally don't think the public would necessarily know any different, for one. And for two, the events that we covered as private paramedics or private medics, the public loves us. I don't think they see us, for example, BMX. BMX absolutely loves us, and they're really passionate about us coming and working for them. And I think they treat us with as much respect, if not more, than the public sector, because they get to see us. They get to see the work we do all the time. While you may have different experiences with the public sector, I don't think the public itself knows any different or values private paramedics any less.
Culture does. So, I mean, you're not really a real paramedic unless you've been in a state service. Is that right, Andy?
I'm not falling for your trick, Sonny. All right, I'm not falling for
He's
it.
He's just trying
buddy.
To poke the bear.
I saw you coming, buddy.
why does this exist though, Andy? Because I've certainly seen this, I've heard it, I've experienced it. You're not a real paramedic until you've been in a state service. Why does this exist?
I think it's probably a hangover from the fact that up until 2018, as you mentioned earlier, the term paramedic wasn't a protected term. We weren't actually a legitimate, if you want to use that term, profession. And so anyone that was working in the private sector was often kind of labelled differently. There were issues around things like scope of practice, and that's a really deep, dark hole we probably won't go down today, but around things like, drug therapy protocols, as Kat had already mentioned, the ability to access drugs and use drugs, et cetera, so you had limited scopes. I think it's a combination of all of those things, but I'd just like to go back quickly to what Kat said, and I completely agree that, you know, when you're in that mosh pit, Kat, you know, we've got a seizing patient, as we do, in the middle of a throng of 10,000 people jumping up and down, not one of those people stopped to read our epaulets or ask for our registration number or ask which ambulance service we work for. They just part like the Red Sea, because no one wants to touch that patient, and then we do our job and we get them out of there and we do a really good job. And so for my mind, I completely agree with everything that you said around sort of that perspective. But I just want to throw this out there as well. I was recently on a Twitter thread where I found something incredibly interesting come up, which was a number of people entered the thread from the UK. And one of them got quite defensive in and around this idea of a paramedic is basically, you know, a jurisdictional ambulance driver. That was his jam. That's what he was going down. And there was a number of us, particularly from the Australian side, sort of saying, well, no, that's what perhaps we were. We've evolved past that, and certainly we've all moved on. And then we started using things like event paramedicine. We talked about private sector mining. We talked about community paramedicine, extended care, tactical medicine. We had a fairly extensive list of examples for him. And he basically said, well, I'm sick and tired of these private sector paramedics looking down their nose at us just everyday ambos on road. And I was like, but hold up, because clearly that's the opposite to the perspective that we see here in Australia. And so from their perspective over there, they seem to have, at least based on this Twitter thread, a bit of a difference in that opinion, that these specializations are actually put up on a higher pedestal than, you know, your everyday average baggy-ass ambo just driving.
Oh, that's see, Nick, there's hashtag Andy Bell again, being controversial, dropping statements like, oh.
This is why we bring him on, mate. We don't want to tarnish our own reputation, so we just bring Andy in to do the dirty work for
Hold
us.
On, you told me you were paying me. What?
In love, what mate.
Andy, you mentioned that DDPs, you know, drug therapy protocols, scopes of practice, are a deep, dark rabbit hole to fall into at the moment. And I would agree. It's a separate podcast. It's probably a separate 10 podcasts. You know, a lot of the private providers out there, they've got their own medical directors who set scopes of practice. All of them are based on ambulance jurisdictional structure. The question I have, though, is if we're going to really develop paramedicine, are these not holding us back? Because, you know, all three of us here, and I'm sure Kat as well, we've all worked in events. Most of us have worked in defence contracts. I've been fortunate enough to work on remote research expeditions with Nat Geo Discovery teams doing all kinds of weird and wonderful things. But out there, I don't have a company. I don't have a medical director. I certainly don't have a drug therapy guideline. What I've got is my paramedic registration. Now, this is a very grey area to operate and practice in, because then I've got to basically fall back on my registration and the language that has actually evolved around that. And so this is it's extraordinarily difficult in Australia at the moment as a paramedic working for non-clinical companies to access things like pharmacology. And this is where some of the culture comes from. Well, if you're not carrying S8 drugs, you're not a paramedic. There's a lot we can do, though, without S8 drugs. And again, I think this comes down to the specializations that you're referring to. So my question to anyone, you know, Nick, Andrew and Kat, is are scopes of practice and DDPs likely to hold us back, or are these a necessary part of what we're doing in the private sector?
I don't think it can be holding us back if we see our value as a paramedic and we base our value as a paramedic on what we can do, what's in our drug kits, what's in our bags, that kind of thing. And I think historically we have done that in the past. We've gone, I can give 16 drugs, so I'm this good, or I can put a piece of plastic through someone's vocal cord, so I'm this good. Like, when we really moving forward, we shouldn't be basing our worth or our value based on what's within our scope of practice. It should be what's between our ears. That's where your value is. And do far more good with what's between your ears than what's in your bag.
Yeah, I'm gonna use this opportunity to flip it towards the education perspective, and I'm gonna direct it at Kat. So no pressure, Kat. Which is, you know, all of those things that both Sunny and Nick have just discussed are evident, I guess, to people in the working environment. But my question to someone like yourself, who's only recently, you know, finished your formal studies, were you made aware of these types of discrepancies? Was that part of your education, or do you feel like that's perhaps something that's missing from the current paramedic education paradigm?
Can I expand on that even more, Kat, and say, did your degree that you finished prepare you for working in the private sector?
Well, what a good question. Well, to an extent, I think there was a clear transition happening at my university as I was going through it, where in the first year, QAS was everything. I did my studies in Brisbane, so QAS was all the questions on the test. all the DTPs we had to learn was just refer to QAS, et cetera. But in my second year, it's when we covered all of our med surge, our trauma, our cardiac, respiratory, and neurological emergencies. And there was a big shift between you can look at the CPGs, the guidelines, and you can look at them like you would at Wikipedia, but you need to follow the actual source. And at no point were we quizzed or tested on the actual CPGs, DTPs of the services that in that state, but we were actually exploring, but why? And we were actually really pushed. We even looked at Trauma Victoria, which is designed for doctors and nurses out of hospital and hospital care. And they really made us think, I guess, as to why things are happening, as opposed to you must follow the guidelines, because we are registered. We no longer can rely on the guidelines, so to speak. We need to be able to make decisions as clinicians using, you know, our pathophysiology knowledge and our pharmacology knowledge and go from there. And the whole curriculum has been completely revamped by Dr. Scott Devenish since I left. And I had a chat to him and he said that he's a big proponent of preparing us for even international work in Canada. So he was very big on don't stick to the guidelines of the service in which you're, you know, the state in which your university is based in, but rather you have to be able to use your brain. But that said, we were still quite limited in what we can do in the private sector, because in the private sector, our response time is seconds, if not under a minute, where we can see what actually happened. Whilst university still teaches you, you know, you get on scene and it's been 20 minutes, it's been an hour, 2 hours. And that actually makes quite a big difference that we don't think about. Like I can see concussion, for example, go from point of contact in the private sector to really developing quite poorly, and I can record all that and I can track all the changes. But going to a concussion as a jurisdictional paramedic, I'm turning up 20 minutes or an hour later, where I can't necessarily tell what the person was like beforehand. Is this the normal? And if there's no loved ones, I can treat not necessarily to the way that I should be treating, but you can't help that. I wasn't there when a concussion necessarily happened. So some food for thought.
It's a really, really good point, Kat. And I love the fact that you've talked about that longevity of the job and that continuity of care. And that is one of the big differences, isn't it? Often in the private sector is that you are, you know, on the spot. And therefore, you know, your care is starting from, you know, really, I guess it's funny, isn't it? Because paramedics are often given that term first responder, but they're actually about the 30th person on scene, because every other man and his dog, particularly if it's a road traffic crash, the towies, who will be there like at least 20 minutes before everybody else, they're the only actually real first responders. Whereas in the private sector, yeah, you are. You literally can watch it happen in front of you. So it's a really good point.
That was a really big adjustment for myself too, coming from an ambulance background. Is when you dispatch to something, you don't just have information paged to you. You've then got time to drive and actually prepare, whether that be 30 seconds or 20 minutes. You still got time to prepare. And I used to find it amusing how many people would claim to be first on scene when there's actually about 20 or 30 people there when they arrived. And I think the point that you've mentioned there, Kat, the difference in care when you are actually Johnny on the spot, it's a dramatic difference in the way that you've got to structure your approach, because your amygdala activates and you're there. You're supposed to be providing care immediately. You do not have that preparation time. And this is one of the reasons why I've got a lot of respect for paramedics who are working in the private sector. I don't necessarily think that they are supported enough through their education. They certainly don't have graduate years to be mentored or mentored through. And then they also don't have any preparation time when something actually happens. They are literally there and have to work through it. So I think it's a drastically different dynamic to actually be practicing, and regardless of if they're CPGs or not.
There's a massive difference between being the person that witnesses the seizure.
Salad.
You don't want too many salads. They're always a myth. Or being told, you know, that you're going to one, and then you have that 10 minutes to like get your head around the fact that you could be getting there to see someone seizing. You know, that's a very different physiological response. As Sonny was talking about, you know, you get that hypersympathetic response, that amygdala hijack, where you suddenly everything just kind of melts down, and you need to get past that, which is really cool. So I feel like your systems, particularly at that initial contact, have to be really, really solid in the private sector, particularly in some of those events when you are literally the first person there. Because if your system fails, then the whole thing will come undone very, very quickly, doesn't it? And then it will all just start piling on. And then you will often have those large number of external variables as well. You know, for example, you know, we talk back to the time that you and I worked together at that festival. There were, I don't know what, there were the 25,000 odd people at that thing. The music was not exactly quiet. You know, people were well and truly off their chops. And so, you know, you're not just dealing with a sick person, you're dealing with the environment in which you're operating as well. So there's a huge number of variables that you need to consider.
Kat, why do you think your colleagues want to go to state-based ambulance services? Why don't you think there's a drive or an inclination for your colleagues to want to really foster a career in the private industry?
Well, I think there's two kind of pathways to consider here. One pathway is that, as far as I'm aware, especially for colleagues that are on the same level in their profession as I am, I don't think you can actually qualify in the private sector and become a paramedic.
Interestingly, Kat, that's a false expectation. Ooh. In our industry. The notion of a graduate paramedic is actually a jurisdictional influence that has still infected our profession. Now, there's going to be two camps, people saying you need it and others saying you don't need it. And there's some going to be saying it's done well and not done well. But this notion that you're not a real paramedic until you've been a state paramedic is part of this problem. Is people don't realise that when they finish their degree and register, they are a registered, autonomously practising paramedic under the same rules and regulations that anyone who's got 10 years of state ambulance has got from day one. So if you want to go on to study a master's, you can. There are still going to be jobs out in the private sector that will say things like a prerequisite is 5 years experience in jurisdictional ambulance. But a lot of that is actually dying now because there's, most people who have that kind of experience have now settled into a job, a career, a house and a family and are doing other things. So it's interesting to even hear that this is still influencing things because it's a very false notion. And Andy, I can see you're agreeing with me there. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I agree with what you said. The difference is, so you... The graduate paramedic kind of restrictions that are placed on someone when they start with a jurisdictional ambulance service are created purely by that ambulance service. So the limitation in your scope of practice, shall we call it, is only there because the ambulance service dictates it to be so. Technically, under APRA, you can do all of your professional capabilities from the day you start. But the ambulance service will say, no, you can't, because we want you to show us that you can do it safely. Now, that's okay. I don't actually have an issue with that because we need to learn. But it is, in fact, an untruth that you can't operate as a fully fledged, grown up paramedic from the day that you start.
I feel like this is part of the reason that they would be underestimated and underutilized. Mm. This is part of the reason that people don't think they're a real paramedic yet, is because of this false notion.
Yeah, yeah.
We should start a side podcast called Paramedic Mythbusters.
I don't know if Hayden Barron would appreciate that. He's been doing a great job of it. There's a shout out to him too. If you haven't been on Paramedic Mythbusters, jump on.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Hey, so I'm sorry, but Kat had a second point, and Sonny, you jumped in. So I'm keen to hear what Kat's second point
I'll mute
was.
Myself.
Yeah.
Well, I think the second point is that really, I also think that's not necessarily true that people want to just work for the state service. If anything, I've come across a fantastic paramedic when I worked at the music festival, and he's been a qualified paramedic in South Wales, and he's worked in a really heavily Muslim community, as he was saying, and so he was exposed to working. He was really good at working with patients that don't speak the language. He was really good at working with the vulnerable groups, etc. But because of the heavy Muslim-based community, he did not get exposure to drugs and alcohol because such as, you know, not part of the Muslim faith. So he actually joined the private sector because he wanted to work festivals. He wanted to work in an area that constantly gave him exposure to drugs and alcohol and polypharmacy and that kind of stuff, because he worked there for years and he just felt like that was his big weakness as a clinician, that he just was never exposed to that kind of clientele, so to speak. So I think people still, there are still paramedics that are qualified and working in the jurisdictional section that still put their hand up and want to get exposed to more, for example, trauma. People want to work BMX, they want to be there on scene, they want to work the trauma, because, you know, working for a jurisdictional, especially in the metro area service, you see a lot of nanas having a fall or a lot of chronic conditions, but you don't actually get exposed to thinking quick on your feet if you do see trauma. So I think that's a bit of a myth buster on my end to you.
It's a great point, Kat. I've seen more tubes at music festivals and private providers than I ever saw on road.
Hey, Kat, you've worked in both the private sector now and an ambulance service like the rest of us. I'm curious to hear your experience in relation to exposure, because one of the things that we certainly hear or used as a way to, I guess, almost subjugate the private paramedics is lack of exposure. They don't get enough exposure to things. What's your take? Agree, disagree?
Well, what's exposure? It's a different type of exposure. Am I seeing as many chronic conditions? Am I seeing as much exacerbation of COPD in the private sector as I am seeing in the public? Absolutely not. I work in Bundaburg. Everyone has COPD here because of the burnouts.
God's waiting room.
Oh, wow. Boom.
Yes, it's so prevalent here. But once again, when I now in the public sector, now that I go to someone that has hit their head or had concussion or even kids, I am so much better at assessing a child or speaking to a child and just being an overall better clinician to a child, because that's all I was exposed to. I was exposed to kids playing sport and I'm really good at doing concussion assessments. I don't think my university education prepared me at all for how deep the concussion assessment needs to be. And it's even as something as, can you remember the color I give you? That I say that to a patient and my colleagues turn back and they look at me and they're like, what is she doing? And then the patient can't remember the color I gave them in like 5 minutes. And suddenly we go from a patient that a little bit forgetful, maybe concussed, to like, oh yeah, this patient is not well at all. They need to go and see further definitive care. I think it depends on kind of exposure, really.
I think you've nailed it. Absolutely. You know, in the ambulance, it's very much a generalist role. You get, you know, a little bit of exposure to a lot of different things, whereas it, as Andy was pointing out earlier, the private sector is going to be specialising in a lot of different areas. And so the exposure to those specialist roles is going to be completely different.
And the premise that you're going to have more exposure or better exposure in an ambulance service over the private industry is just simply wrong. It's just... In today's context, it's not true anymore. There's plenty of state-based ambulance paramedics in working in certain areas that don't do much at all, and there's certainly plenty of private paramedics who do a lot of complex work.
We're tipping over a bit of our time here, so we're going to have to wrap up. Kat, thanks heaps for being with us. Have you got any other parting knowledge or pearls of wisdom for anyone out there who's thinking about entering the private sector?
I just think they absolutely should, even for... I just love the work, especially because you get to work with what I found absolutely beneficial is getting to actually work with nurses, work with them side by side, and they can give you excellent bits of knowledge, or working with med students or doctors that once again can give you such an in-depth understanding for why we do things the way we do, why we need the neuro assessment to be more thorough, or why is the ECG looking the way it is. I think just because we don't get exposed to enough different schools of thought working as paramedics, unless you're seeking it out yourself, that working in the private sector is really giving you that ability to talk to anyone with all sorts of different backgrounds. CCPs, you can work for hours with a CCP and you can ask him all sorts of things, really pick their brain on nurses or doctors or even other state providers, really.
Yeah, that's all really, really great information, Kat. Thanks very much for putting the article together. It was definitely a great read. I know that we had a lot of response from people who were saying, hey, look, you know, this is a great perspective and it's given me an opportunity to maybe readdress some of the ways I think about things as well. So hopefully more people will have a listen to this podcast and it will start the wheels spinning on their thoughts and processes as well. So thanks very much for contributing. We really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Guys, I think that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Shift Extension. If you have any questions, qualms, queries, or concerns, please reach out to us. You can find us on Facebook, send us an email, or come find us in person. But until next time.